let's start with a word of prayer. Who wants to lead us in that?
Thanks, Drunk.
Let's pray. Dear God, thank you so much for this day. Thank you for this midweek time where we can just sit down and study more from your word. Just be with us as we go about this study. Help us to have open hearts to hear what Brother Jeff has to bring to us. Be with us throughout the rest of the week. Just help us to shine our lights everywhere we go. Help the time that we're together be a time where we can be vulnerable and to learn and to draw strength from each other so that when we go out into the world, we can shine our lights brightly and show the world who you are by our actions and our words. Thank you for everything you do for us. In your son's name we pray. Amen.
Thank you. All right, so I should get there myself. So, you know, we're on the back side of the book, and it'll get a little more theological again here next week when we look at 22 to 24 and then wrap it up. If you like it, 22 a little bit, nah, probably not. But we've got too much to talk about with the Levitical cities, man. That's a whole large chapter. Well, you're excited, they end up laughing. So anyways, remember what we've been doing last week, with chapters 14 through 19, the tribal allotment, and as much as that seems relatively boring, there's actually a lot of significant theological substance there, a lot of what sits underneath some of this, and even tonight, Genesis 49, when Jacob was, we usually say he blessed his sons, but if you're sitting in Levi, not so much. In fact, that, we're going to touch on that a little bit with, because we're talking about the Levitical cities tonight, this is Levi's. The tribe of Levi share. And so again, some echoes of Genesis 49 hanging a little bit over that. So there's a lot more, just like genealogies in the Bible, there's a lot more going on. It seems pedantic, it seems boring, until you kind of, you know, look at it from outside the modern American westernized Bible. So same thing last week we talked about a lot, you know, that you know, for all of our kind of, you know, treating like flyover country. There's a number of important things going on, emphasizing number one, you know, this was done by lots, not the Oklahoma land rush. This was God handing out the land. That matters. You know, we talk about other, you know, it helps us make sense of other stories in the Bible. Everything from God reminding Israel when they get uppity, the land is mine. You know, even when you have the land, it's not really yours. Emphasizes, again, the gravity of the fact that to the best of, you know, the Old Testament's revelation, they never, ever, ever kept the Sabbath year or, even more significantly, the Jubilee year. And of course, the Jubilee year, what was supposed to happen with the land? Went back to the original allotments, i.e., you know, what we're talking about here. And why did that matter? Because God wanted everybody to have a chance. And so he stopped and think about it, and with, you know, a little sidebar on the Sabbath, you know, really what God did is God had claimed every seventh unit of time. Every seventh day. And then the kind of the seventh month, I mean, it's not officially grabbed, but it's the holiest month of the year, has everything from the, you know, starts with the Feast of Trumpets, Day of Atonement, got the Feast of Booths, and so more set-aside days in the seventh month. I don't think that's by accident than anything else. And so you go seventh day, seventh month, then comes what would be the next unit of time, seventh year, Sabbath, right? God claimed that one, and that's when debts are, you know, that's a little bit of that's a mini reset. Every seventh year, debts are forgiven, and God was very clear in the law. Go back and read the law. You know, if it's year number six, and so, you know, if you loan money this year, you're probably not getting it back because, you know, they, you know, God was very clear, don't be stingy. You know, if somebody needs the money, you loan it, even though you're not going to get it back, there's not going to be time to pay it back. You know, I'm a generous God, you be generous to your brother. And then comes, you know, every seventh year, i.e. the Jubilee. And that's where it ends, because we stop thinking about it, that seventh year, Jews debated whether it was the year number 49 or 50, but that's, we'll leave that for the Pharisees and the others to figure out. The bottom line is that's kind of the limit of a human lifespan. So once per human lifespan, every seventh unit of time was claimed. And so what really happened is once per lifetime with the Jubilee year, which was an anticipation. You know, Jesus makes this clear, the favorable year of the Lord, Isaiah, that's Jubilee year in Isaiah. It's really an antecedent of the gospel of what Jesus is going to do, the ultimate reset of reality. Once every lifetime, there's a complete reset. Not only are all debts forgiven, slaves free, but even the land goes back to the baseline. And then, and so of course, you really hope that you know, the Jubilee doesn't happen when you're like 20 years old and have a chance to, you know, empty the bank account, rack up the debts, spend the kids' inheritance, and then get it all forgiven. But, yes, sir.
So, as far as the Jubilee, just really quick.
Yeah.
The seventh of the seventh.
Seventh of seven, seven, yeah. The seventh of seven.
The 49th year.
Yeah.
I've heard that it was supposed to be the 49th and the 50th year.
Yeah. And that's where the Jews themselves debated what was the right interpretation. So, the seventh Sabbath year double as the Jubilee year, or was year number five? Because what's interesting is Pentecost has the same calculation, right? Right, yeah, exactly. Rudy's thinking that way. The science math guys are like, wheels are turning, doing the math. How does this work? Yeah, because the Pentecost really is kind of the eighth day. What's interesting about that is the early church talked about the resurrection as being the eighth day, i.e. the beginning of a new creation, 7 days of creation, eighth day. You'll see in more liturgical, sometimes Catholic, especially Orthodox, eighth day concept. That's really what we are. We are eighth day people because God started his new creation resurrection on a Sunday. It kind of starts it all over with a new creation. So yeah, it's an interesting question for our purposes. We're not going to keep it. Yeah, but it is. It gets a little... But bottom line is once per lifetime. And the big young jubilee year was the land goes back. Right? We're an agricultural economy. There's no middle class. You don't go to college, you get an accounting job. You know, basically there was the top level elites and everybody else who had to have land to survive. And so once per lifetime, everything goes back, which is also helps to understand, remember, why Naboth, even though Ahab offers him better land for your land, because you just happen to be next door to me and I really want your plot. And Naboth says no. And by the way, not because necessarily Ahab was lying to him. It wasn't, you know, may well have been offering him a literal better piece of land. That wasn't the point for Naboth because he was a righteous man. For Naboth, the point was, why do I have this land? Because it was my father's land. Well, where did he get it from? All the way back to the days of Joshua. And that's why as a righteous man who understands God put my family right where God wanted my family to be. It's not for me to sell. It's not for me to trade out for better. And we talked a little bit last week about that concept of contentment with God's providence in our lives. By all means, Book of Proverbs, work hard, play well, be wise. But at the end of the day, Ecclesiastes, time and chance happen to all. The race will not always be to the swift. At the end of the day, you got to know when to let go and have peace and silence before the Lord. And in your life, like marinating in bitterness or frustration that you played by all the rules and yet you didn't become a millionaire. You know, your life lays exactly where God ultimately wanted it to lay. Naboth understood that. I want to get paid with his life for that understanding. So, anyway, so so it matters. So, number one, the lots. The other big, a couple of big quick takeaways. That section begins with Caleb getting his inheritance and ends with Joshua getting his. Only two named individuals get inheritances, and it matters because who are these two guys? The designated survivors. That's who they are, right? They are the only Exodus generation survivors. So what's the whole point? God remembers those who are faithful to him, even the remnant of the remnant. And by name, they get their spots. And Caleb especially is eager to go get it, man. But anyways, and so that's number two. And then number three, the other big thing to pick up on was already we saw the beginnings of the north-south tension, which goes back to Genesis 49. The north-south tension, we think about Ephraim and Manasseh, but that's the double portion birthright. It's really Joseph versus Judah. And that goes all the way back to Genesis when the tension was between Joseph and Judah. And again, part of what happens there, so you already see this, they are the dominant tribes. Landmass, everything else, and they become the north and the south. Right? Where's the capital city when the north splits off? It's in Ephraim. Samaria's in Ephraim. What does Hosea call the north? Calls him Ephraim. And so it's really Joseph versus Judah all the way back from Genesis. We won't rehash all that. We talked about that. But it is interesting, too, along that line. Remember, we talked about Jerusalem literally straddles. Go back into the allotments. It straddles. Technically, Benjamite straddles the line between Judah and Benjamin. And so when David becomes king, remember 7 years in Hebron, because of Saul, the northern part of the country, even then did not want David to rule over them. Abner does his thing, brings everybody together, and David quickly takes Jerusalem, makes that the capital city. And part of it, certainly that's where God wants to place his name, but it's never been Jewish before. It was always Jebusite. And so David puts capital then, bridging north and south, literally right on the fault line, geographically, historically, and so forth. Absolutely brilliant and providential on David's part. And then last little bit of that perennial north-south tension, going back to those two individual guys who got allotments, what tribe was Caleb associated with? Judah. What tribe was Joshua associated with? Ephraim. North and south, all the way through. Fascinating. All right, so the fault lines, Genesis to Joshua, to then eventually in the kings, in the story. That fault line between Judah and Joseph runs on and on and on. So all this matters, so you know, we emphasize God's providence, we emphasize the natural fault lines of the people, because they can't bury the hatchets going back to their parents and their forefathers' days. We want to see some of the fault lines, even in the geography. Of course, God's putting them where he wants them, because he knows. You know, God's setting it all up. God knows the end from the beginning. And then and again, just, you know, God's faithful to his promises. No good thing has failed to come to pass. But we're not quite done divvying everything up there. Because you look at the end of chapter 19, you know, look at the text, it sounds like we're done. Except I'm going to turn the page to chapter 20, and we're not. What, you mean we're still doing geography class here? Yeah, but it matters. Okay? And so I want you to stop and think about this. Just when you think you're done, and we've got the tribes lined out, but of course, if you're keeping score at home, you're like, oh, wait, what about Levi? And Genesis 49, Simeon and Levi shall be scattered. Simeon is scattered because he's scattered within Judah. There's no tribal boundary, only cities, unlike all the other tribes. Levi gets cities literally scattered all the way through. God's promise, chapter 21 names the cities. But the six cities of refuge in chapter 20, I don't know if I said that right, 21 Levitical cities, 48 of them, six cities of refuge, three on each side of the Jordan, north, middle, south. So basically, you can get there. Now, you'll help me out a little bit because I'm rambling on and on here. From Exodus, from Numbers, who remembers what the cities of refuge are about? What are those about?
If you were to accidentally kill someone, normally the family members of the person that died are going to try and get you.
Yep.
So you fled to the city of refuge to get justice, to get a trial.
Yeah.
But don't be just killed.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, we have to understand in the ancient Near East, really, you know, across the ancient world, the concept of the blood feud, the blood debt, the Oresteia, you know, this was how it worked across ancient cultures, was if, and it doesn't really matter who's, you know, whether it was culpable, murderous, whatever, if my father, my son, my brother is dead, and somehow, you know, whether it was premeditated murder, even if it was just, you know, I'm swinging the hammer, my hands are sweaty, lose grip, take, you know, crush drunk skull accidentally, I'm running from Dan. That's how it worked. But the problem was there was no offering to this because, so fine, Dan finds me and kills me. What's Joel got to do now? Go hunt Dan. And then when Joel gets Dan, what's Dreyson got to go do? Yeah, right? And that was the whole point. Eye for an eye, you know, just, it was, and that's how it was. And so here's God come on saying, again, my people are to be a light to the nations. This is, you know, we're not going to do this nonstop off-ramp bloodshed, senseless, vengeful violence that's more based in emotion, anger, and hate than reason and justice. The Greeks will come up with their own solution. But this was God's. This was God's. And so if you accidentally killed somebody, and again, east side of the river, middle, north, south, you could run to the city of refuge. Now, here's the thing. What happens if I really didn't like Logan, and I just decided to, you know, kill him at work today, and I ran to the city of refuge? What then?
There'd be a trial. Yeah. Find out.
There would be an inquiry into the circumstances of the death. And when they became, you know, they saw me posting hateful things on social media before I killed him. Then it'd be different. Right? There would be really no, I could run the city of refuge all day long, but when the elders of the city are going to make inquiry into the circumstances of how Logan died, and it comes out, you know, people overheard me saying, I hate Logan, I can't wait to kill him. Guess what? No city of refuge for me to take me out and they execute me. But, you know, if we're at work today, my hand is sweaty, I lose grip of the hammer, smack Logan in the head accidentally, he's dead. Sorry, Sarah, but no justice for you. No. So go back a step. Okay, so here we are. It's a really happy time, right? Joshua's, you know, overall a very positive book, a couple of hiccups, but again, you know, people get back on the right track. God is merciful. We've just had seen God fulfill his promises, long-standing promises to Abraham. They waited centuries for the land promise to be fulfilled. Why? So what's this about? Why is God doing this, and why now in the book?
Well, they're dividing up the land, so it makes sense.
Okay. Why not lead with this? Why put this at the end instead of the beginning of the divisions? What possible kind of thinking through the logic or the kind of the flow? What would be accomplished by that? Yeah, Rudy.
And does it have anything to do with why they the problem that they thought they were going to have before they crossed the Jordan, where if they gave an allotment to those people going to stay there and not participate in?
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's funny you say that because, yeah, I mean, they already had the three, you know, kind of set aside in the Trans-Jordan, right?
But they wanted everybody to participate in.
Yeah. Yeah, there was certainly a quest for unity, and this was one of the great unifying things. of the people was, he said, again, you know, Exodus and Numbers anticipated these cities of refuge. So I mean, this was actually always part of the deal. But here's the reality. A couple of things that this brings out. Number one, as great as things are going, is there still human fallenness? Is Eden always at risk? Always. But here's the other thing. Does the anger of man work the righteousness of God either? I read that somewhere else in the Bible, I think, once or twice, right? Was God warmed up? God, man's anger does not produce the righteousness of God. So there also, not only will there be sin and we need to deal with murder and so forth appropriately, but on the flip side, you know, accidents in a fallen world will happen. You know, there is certainly negligent homicide. I mean, our legal codes recognize that, but there's also just truly, it was a tragic accident. You know, I was driving a speed limit. I was being careful. I had my hands on the wheel at 2 and 10. I was not texting while driving. And the kid just out of a blind spot behind a mailbox jumped in front of my car and I hit the kid. Horrible things happen in the fallen world. And the kid's dead, but there's no criminal liability there, right? I mean, certainly tried to kill the kid, was driving as carefully as I could, and just kids do stuff like that, right? We go and raise kids, you know exactly that fear and why we, you know, train our kids from the time they start toddlers. Don't chase them all in the street, let them all get run over, not you. So just stuff happens. And there's gotta be a way. God recognized that justice is not vengeance.
Didn't they become kind of wall of cities because anybody who was wanting to avoid the bloodshed would kind of run there to hide?
Well, that was part of the whole point of, you know, kind of what Dan brought. You know, we're going to, you know, they were responsible for making inquiries so that the system was not abused. Now, again, we're talking the ideal here, kind of keeping the Jubilee year. Yeah, you know, good luck with that, right? but in theory, again, the law, the wise law that God is giving them, in theory, yes, this is a way to straddle that. You know, when you're going to, you know, you can't grab the horns of the altar, so to speak, when you're a murderer and expect to, you know, be inviolable. Take him out and kill him. Execute him. But here's the other big thing you have to understand. Life matters to God. Life matters to God. It's one of the most fundamental concepts. Life matters to God. You go back to what's the first person-on-person sin in Genesis? What's the first story we have outside of Eden? A brother kills a brother. And so it goes. Genesis chapter 6. Anybody remember among all the descriptions of why God was ready to flood the world? Anybody remember Genesis 6 beginning of that chapter? Nonstop.
Violence.
Hamas. I don't know if you realize that Palestinian group's name. It's not nice. Hamas is a Semitic word for violence. Yeah. For people, you know, Westerners, they name themselves violence. They don't, you know, they don't want a two-state solution. They want extermination. You know, kind of, anyways, they literally, it's in the name, folks. So yeah, John God, I'm sick of the Hamas. I'm sick of the violence. Because unrestrained human anger, hate, vengeance, this is what we get to. Civilization hangs by a thread. We don't realize how many, you know, in our system, as imperfect as it may be in theory and in practice, the alternative of anarchy and blood on blood is far worse. Civilization, trial by jury, hangs by a thread, man. Hangs by a thread. The normal course of human events is violence. It just always devolves back into violence. What's the mark of a failed state or a failed government? Violence. You know, what's one of my favorite definitions of the government? The government is whatever entity has a monopoly on violence. What's like that definition?
Well, and some philosopher said that it's how they treat their elderly and their children.
Well, if there's if it's a just order.
If it's unjust, then the elderly and the children.
Well, yeah.
Are abused or neglected.
Yeah, just as a side, I appreciate the observation, just as a sidebar. The canary in the coal mine for any society, no matter how comfortable you may be, you know, and you're being left alone by the government, canary in the coal mine is always, what does the society do with the young and the old? And so, by the way, are there red lights going off all around the Western world right now? Yeah, because it started with abortion, and now it's starting to become more and more acceptable, common. Euthanasia. If you're not paying attention, Canada's all in on it. More and more European countries are embracing it. It started with the young. Remember the old slogan, abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. Yeah, exactly. But these kind of manipulative slogans. But what's in just, you know, they weren't messing with me, I'm already born. In fact, one of my favorite bumper stickers ever, you know, 100% of pro-life people have already been born. The hypocrisy's kind of interesting. you know, but anyways, it is interesting as a society goes, you know, the more you become, and the more you rationalize, and the more you sear the conscience and make immune your system of justice to the very young and then eventually the very old. You listen. Not becoming for you yet, but history is replete with warnings about societies that begin to go after the young and the old. Yeah, drunk.
When we talk about the cities of refuge, my mind goes to the layout of the camp that God had them do when they were traveling through the wilderness,
yeah.
And how some tribes were a little bit closer to the tabernacle and then some were more on the outside.
Correct.
And how it seems like now they're even more spread out, like across the whole region. And God doesn't want his presence or his salvation to be far from them, that them to have to travel to Jerusalem or something. He wants it to be close to them that they can flee to. And that just, to me, rings the Psalms all the way through of God is my refuge and strength.
Yeah.
He doesn't help in trouble, that kind of thing.
It's funny you say that because, and I can't remember the cohorts, which one was in the north, the west, and the south. I just made it up. The Gershonites, the Kohathites, and the Merarites. But yeah, the camp, to Drock's point, the camp was actually numbers organized. Again, it was just like the lots determined who gets what land. The camp was organized, three tribes, three tribes, three tribes, three tribes, with the inner ring being the door was guarded by the priests, and the other three Levitical clans were then arranged around. And they all had their prescribed duties for moving the tabernacle and things like that. But what's interesting was the other thing that's often missed is, and this actually comes back to now as we talk about the Levitical cities, because there is a pattern to this as well. They were all entrusted by God to kill if anybody approached who was supposed to be in proximity to the tabernacle. And then interesting, guard the garden, you know, right? What Adam was originally supposed to do, Shamar in Hebrew, he wasn't just supposed to keep it, he was supposed to guard it. And then he didn't. And so priests, the idea of a priest with God is not merely ministering in worship, it's guarding the holiness of God. And so they are entrusted with that. And so again, it's interesting. Refuge, cities of refuge could have been, why can't we just have, the Naphtalites worry about their city of refuge and the Judites worry about the city of refuge? But no, they're also Levitical cities. You can stop and think about that. What's the significance of making cities of refuge also the cities of the Levites? They've had this job for a while, to guard the holiness of God, be the keepers and enforcers of the law. And it goes all back to remember, how did God choose the tribe of Levi in the first place? Despite Jacob's harsh words about his son Levi's consequences. And it's interesting how God split that difference. They're still scattered. But what, you remember Exodus 32? What happened that God caused God to choose them as the priestly tribe? Under what circumstances?
At the golden calf, they were the ones that went through and killed all of them.
And God says, audition accepted. I like your tape. Good game film. You got the job. You guys understand what this is about. And so they were tasked by God from that point forward with literally being his muscle, his enforcers. And when they failed, here come the prophets. Because that's the thing. Prophets weren't supposed to be routine. Prophets show up because the kings and the priests failed. And then here comes a prophet saying, thou art the man, and so on and so forth. And so, yeah, when things are running smoothly, you don't really need a prophet to come and enforce the covenant because the priests and the king are handling it. And so it makes sense that the cities of refuge are, in fact, Levitical cities. And now, again, for sake of time, because this is how we never finish our quarter. If you look at, for sake of time, I could do this in chapter 21. But if you look at the rest of the Levitical cities, they are divvied up by their clans. Because they always go by their groups. Now, what's interesting is the priests are part of the Kohathites, because that was Moses' family, which means that was Aaron's family. So the priests, the actual priests, are a subset of the Kohathites through the family of Aaron. You had to be from the family of Aaron within the Kohathites to be a priest. But then you have the rest of the Kohathites who were cousins, so to speak, in good southern fashion. Everybody's a cousin. And so the rest of the Kohathites get their allotment. And so it's interesting, when you look at the cities of refuge, it starts with the priests. Which Levitical cities go to the priests? And then come the Kohathites, and then you get the Merarites and the Gershonites. I can't say it tonight. And you get the point. Not that you're listening anymore. Ooh, aw, man. Just checking. Thank you for listening. All right. So we're back to, though, let's not leave this point too quickly. Life matters to God. So this is all about, you know, what was the first, you know, after we sin, and then, this is interesting, once you sin against God, the violence against man is only inevitable. 20th century taught us that, right? Nietzsche starts the 20th century with God is dead. And what's the 20th century? Bloodiest century in human history.
Humanist manifesto.
Well, then, you know, Marx's ideas get put into action. Nazi ideas get put into action, you know, from the right and the left. And the Nazis love Nietzsche. Now, to be fair, I run this, this is Freedom's Church of this, Nietzsche was not anti-Semitic. The Nazis used Nietzsche selectively. But they didn't like him because God is dead, which means, you know, all things are possible. And so, yeah, you know, literally the century in which Enlightenment rationalism leads to robust atheism. In other words, once you get God out of the picture, when you have Genesis 3, what comes next? Genesis 4. This is how it works. When the logical conclusion, especially at the end, you get violence and you get death. Life matters to God, and that's why. So the you got Genesis 4, Cain and Abel. You got Genesis 6, Hamas. There's too much violence. I'm done with this.
Yeah, Lamech before that.
Well, that's the thing. In the line of Cain and Lamech, actually, you know, if Cain was a murderer, I've perfected it, man. You know, Lamech was just a gift that keeps on giving. He's also the first bigamist. You know, he invented bigamy. And,
killed a child.
Yeah, at least man on man, Cain and Abel, but yeah, he's actually boasting. And he wounded me, man. I just put that kid in his place. It's kind of like the guy who plays dodgeball with kindergartners. Anyways. But then comes Genesis 9. It's interesting, though. Here's the thing, though. So you got to remember, Hamas is hanging over the flood, the violence. And so when they come off, and you get a new Eden. You get a new Eden, right? Genesis 9, you get a new Eden. Literally. God says, no, be fruitful and multiply. Who's the last guy he said that to? Adam. Is it a renewed creation? Yeah, it is. Who has three named sons? Noah has three named sons, just like Adam did. I mean, just, you know, the parallels are stunning. And then, you know, before Noah quickly sins with fruit, just like Adam and Eve did, God also adds something new that he hadn't had to say before. But remember, what was the thing that got us on the ark, among other things? Hamas, violence, too much violence and bloodshed. And he says, this is the first time he says, basically, you take a life, God actually, and by the way, that's why Genesis 9, we've missed this up sometimes when we say Jesus did away with the Old Testament. No, Jesus did away with the law of Moses. There's parts of the Old Testament that are not law of Moses. Genesis 9 is still in force. It is. And in fact, the apostles admit that in something they say in Acts 15, but that's another class in another quarter. Ask Andrew next quarter when he's teaching Acts. Come on, Hansi. Ask him how Acts 15 comes together with Genesis 9. And anyways. So that's the thing, the whole idea that, you know, capital punishment is immoral today. Not per God. Genesis 9 is still in force. You shed blood, your blood is shed. Murderously. Why? Because that's part why God sent the flood. We're going to stop this whole, you lose God, you lose humanity, you lose life. Leviticus is chock full of, you know, life and death and all that. Life matters to God. So much so that in the law, if an animal takes a human life, the animal is to be put to death. Why? Because it's all attacks on God in effigy. Go back and read Genesis 9 carefully. I may not be able to hit God, but I can hit you, and you bear his image. And so, anyway, so life matters to God. So even in this, another kind of typological evil, there's still fallenness, both in terms of there's going to be accidents. It's just tragic, but somebody's dead. And then, of course, there's still going to be, you know, sometimes murderous violence. God wants it sorted out. Everybody's got their vine and their fig tree, so to speak, but life and death are still the ultimate, you know, mark of sin in this world. And so we have to have a mechanism to both stop the vengeance, so fall the world, bad things happen accidentally sometimes, and also deal with those who legitimately take life. That's going to happen, and we give it back to the priests and the Levites as part of their role. They handle this. So what literally happens, what's interesting, when we think about it this way, as we, you know, why put it here as opposed to lead with it? After all the other tribes get their piece of the land, we end with the tribe that is, in a sense, then tasked with handling at the 30,000-foot level worship and justice. What's the hallmark of life before God? Worship and justice. And so as everybody's, you know, getting their allotment and everybody's looking forward to moving into their new homes and, you know, and meeting their neighbors and et cetera, we end with the divvying up of the land among those who will literally be scattered like leaven, positively, throughout the land. The Levites and the priests, who who are responsible for the worship and maintenance of worship and justice. Because what's the point of, you know, getting life with God? It's not about, you know, health and wealth. It's not Joel Osteen. It's always been about what? Rule my creation well and worship. That's what it's always been about. So priests and Levites who are responsible for the maintenance of the worship and the justice of the land. Set things to right, maintain God's good order, like Adam and Eve were supposed to and failed, and worship. What else are we here for? Yes, sir.
Yeah, because when murder and evil happens, you know, to us, we want justice.
Okay.
And God loves mercy. Like Abel or Cain killed Abel.
Yeah.
And God gave him refuge.
He does. And of course,
it's amazing how
it is
in the hands of God.
Yeah.
It looks different than it looks to us.
Well, and that's the thing is, you know, and that's where, you know, again, and the law of Moses was interesting about this because, you know, the law of Moses also knows that whether because of partiality, you know, you did wrong, but, you know, you're my brother, my sister, my husband, my wife, my kid, so I'm not really going to enforce justice, you know, nepotism, favoritism, to just indifference, to whatever. It's interesting, in the law, God actually takes that, ironically, that right away from human beings in some cases. There are some places in the law where God is explicit, and your eye will have no pity. Yeah, I'm telling you, you have no choice to execute. As Martin Luther, or who is it? No, one of the reformers, or was it one of the Catholics pushing back the reformers famously said one time, let's just kill them all and let God sort them out. so there actually were times of law where God took away the human prerogative to, you will not spare your eye, will have no pity. I've said, you know, if they do this to you. Kind of like Achan. I mean, and that's because ultimately it's God's place to weigh who deserves clemency versus even God has no pity. Achan dies. David is allowed to, the adulterous murderer is allowed to keep his throne, keep his name, keep his dynasty. Well, how's that fair? Man, it's God's business, right? As Abraham once said, and we have to always remind ourselves, as Abraham once said as he was having with God over Sodom and Gomorrah, shall not the judge of the earth do what's right? And this is the problem for human beings, especially today. We want to hold God accountable to what we think is justice. And the reality is, God is the standard of justice, and our job is to simply say that my sense of justice must yield to the Creator's actual justice. And if something needs to change, it's not His ways, it's my mind. And part of it is, ultimately, and this goes back to Isaiah chapter 9 with the coming of the Messiah, you know, all the epithets, all the descriptions of what He'll do, the government will be on His shoulders. Only God is capable of actually bringing perfect justice. Only God alone, because only God alone understands the mystery of good and evil, right? That was the whole point, you know, not tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the whole idea was, you know, God saying, that's not your knowledge to have. And when Job says, I really want to know God, and God asks him those questions from the world, when the whole point was, if you can explain to me these basic things, you would understand the nature of evil and how I run the world, even if I told you. You cannot explain calculus to three-year-olds, but boy, we have a hard time accepting that as human beings.
His ways are past finding out because we don't understand it.
Correct. God literally says that. My ways are in that same context where he's always talking about to what would you liken or compare me, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so the challenge of being human, some of you've heard me say this before, but just really wrestle with this, it's hard. The challenge of being human is being enough like God to understand what the questions are. But because we're not God, not being able to have or even understand the answers. That's the hard part about being human. I'm enough like God. You know, my dog does not wonder about why her kid, you know, her puppy got run over by a car. But sometimes with one of my kids, I do. Right? The dogs don't lose. I'm enough like God. I understand what the questions are. But because I'm not God, I don't have a right to the answer, and nor would I probably even understand it if God told me. Being a proud dad, I didn't think Ava was a smart kid. But if I were to sit Ava down and try to do differential equations with her tonight, it's not going to happen. Why? No matter how hard she tries and I try, why? She can't understand it. And we forget, as human beings, whether you're 7 or 77, we are always creatures looking into the unfathomable depths and mysteries of Almighty. So at the end of the day, all we can do is exactly what Job did when all was said and done. Just say, you're right, I repent, dust and ashes. I've got to let you be you and have enough faith to just accept the fact that you do what's right. though he slay me, I will trust him. Not easy, but this is what we're trying to get to as human beings. Yes, ma'am, sister.
This is the Abbot Amari.
Say again?
The Abbot.
Oh, did you look it up for me? Yeah. Thank you. So, yeah, so it was the Catholics then. Catholics on Protestants.
During
got
the Crusades.
It. Got it. Yeah, kill them all that God sort of out.
Well, it was originally kill them all for God knows his own.
Oh, yeah.
So, and we've changed.
I like the Texan version.
There you go.
A little more quotable. Works on the coffee mug a little better. Or a t-shirt.
It didn't work at the Alamo.
No, it didn't. No, it didn't. Still too soon. All right. Let's do this. Chapter 21. In chapter 21, let's just go and kind of, we got to hit the wrap up, big finale number for the rings. Go to the end of chapter 21. We've already seen language like this as he's wrapped up the actual tribal allotments. Now here we are again wrapping up cities of refuge, Levitical cities. So verse 43, kind of another very summary statement. Thus the Lord gave to Israel all the land that he swore to give to their fathers, and they took possession of it, and they settled there. And the Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he swore to their fathers. Not one of their enemies had withstood them, for the Lord had given all their enemies in their hands. Not one word of all the good promises that the Lord had made to the house of Israel had failed. All came to pass. And that may seem a little redundant, but that's the point. How many times do I have to say all, rest, came to pass? I mean, just that's the whole point, right? To emphasize upon emphasize upon emphasize. And so, something to think about is this. It also heavily references the past, to the fathers and whatnot. How long had they been waiting for this?
Four or 50 years?
Yeah, I mean, we won't do it precisely, but the bottom line is half a millennium. Abraham's been dead a long time. Isaac and Jacob, all the in-between. Even the Exodus generation himself, even Moses himself, is dead. It's really hard to understand. God is not in the same rush on the human time scale that we are. And yet when all is said and done, what's emphasized? The promises of God were kept. And so, again, I always think about that line of Jesus, a little bit of the conflict, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? God. And we have so much more than they have in terms of so many stories of God keeping his word, even though people have to die in the meantime, but yet the word is kept, right? And the understanding that God, who can give life to the dead, simply isn't worried about whether it happens in your 70 years or not. It's going to happen, and with the resurrection, you're going to see it. It's really hard for human beings, I think, sometimes, when we get caught up in the moment, to accept the fact that God is simply not in a rush, but it does come to pass. It does come to pass. And so this text wants to hit it really, really hard with all that comes to pass and rest. It's just very redundant, but it's very emphatic. Everything that God owed to Abraham came to pass. And what does that matter? Because there's a sense in which, according to Paul in Galatians, our own eternal inheritance is really just the ultimate fulfillment of the Abrahamic promise. The seed of Abraham was not the nation. The seed of Abraham was the one. And so ultimately, we are the blessing that God promised Abraham was ultimately the messianic blessing. And so just like they had to wait a long time for the down payment, if you will, the typological Israel 1.0 fulfillment, guess what Israel 2.0, us, has to do sometimes? Wait a long time, so to speak. So far, 2,000 years. The seed of promises, the ultimate fulfillment of those promises. The question is, can you do that? That's what Hebrew tags into, ironically, Hebrews chapter 4, right? But you have the remains of the rest. Joshua didn't give him the real rest. It was just a typological example. But what's the warning that the Hebrew writer gives? Don't be like those who never lived to see the fulfillment of the promise because of grumbling, faithlessness, weakness, and so forth. Of course, he's quoting Psalm 95 as he does this. Don't be like them. Don't have an evil, unbelieving heart. Anyways, all right, rant over. Class done. We will do 22 to 24, God willing, next week. And we will finish the book.